clerk will please announce the parties to argue. All right. Thank you. And can you tell us how to pronounce your name correctly, please, sir?
Kojo Nkansa.
Nkansa. Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, the Honorable Justices of the Court. And just like I said, my name is Kojo Nkansa. And this case on appeal is simple. I submitted this case to the court just because my due process were violated in numerous times. There are two aspects of due process of any action. You have the pre and the post. Both of them were violated. And the crux of the matter is that the appellees, meaning the defendants, submitted a motion, a plea to jurisdiction, and then a plea for the motion for summary judgment. They never consulted me in line with local rules about setting up the date. And coincidentally, I had a family problem, family emergency. My wife has a dislocated joint, and normally I have to drive her to wherever he had to go. So on the 15th of June, I submitted a motion for continuance. I never, the police objected to my motion. After I tried on several times to work with them on the phone, they opposed it. I never heard anything from the court. The crux of the matter here, and the appellees, or the defense lawyer, is fond of leaving the gaps or putting up convoluted or diverting the argument to defocus the issue at hand. The issue here is that I never stated that the defendants did not give me notice of their disputive motions. That's not my argument. The main argument here is that, irrespective of the defective nature of my continuance, motion for continuance, but in terms of due process, I deserve to hear from the court about what they are doing with my motion. If that has happened, maybe this appeal wouldn't be necessary. I never had sufficiently clear, timely notice from the court. The city was on the fellow day. And since I had to take my wife to the doctor, I also requested emergency leave in order to do that. And then if you had to take a look on some of the exhibits that I've touched, that was my exhibit. This was the leave that I requested in order to leave after the fellow day to take care of my wife's situation. So when I never heard from the court, because throughout the case, I had only one continuance, and I submitted it the same way. And we had the continuance by that time. So my second continuance, which proceeded for not having anything to do with how the defendant said the motion, which more or less was a surprise to me, and then it coincided with my wife's medical problem, then I was waiting on the court to make a determination of my continuance. The court took no action, whether it was defective, so they've thrown it away, or just tell me that the time that I have to come to court. It never happened. And due process requirement is that any party has to be notified timely and sufficiently clear message. When the city was on the furlough day, that was July 30th, then the court coordinator, Nancy Bentley, left a phone message at my work, on my work phone. The court had my work phone, the court had my wife's cell phone, the court has my home phone. In due diligence, if important case like that, I was expecting the court to go extra mile in leaving messages so that in any way possible I could have the message to come to court. It never happened. And each time the court coordinator called me at work or at home, I immediately respond to her call. So by common sense or just simple logic, for her not hearing from me of that message should probably prick the court that maybe I was not at work and didn't have the message. And plus, when the city of Dallas is on Federal Day, it's a news. When Fort Worth is on Federal Day, it's a news that I hear. Anybody listening to news will know what's going on with our cities. So that never happened. So I did not have a clear, timely notice, and then the court also failed to do anything about the continuance. The motion for my continuance. That's number one issue. The second one is that when I put in my motion to vacate, reconsider, and then reinstate the trial date, when the hearing came on, to my surprise, the defendant derailed it and put it out of focus again, talking about I had a clear advance notice of their disputative motion, the plea to the jurisdiction and all. That's not the argument. I went to court that day to controvert the very orders dismissing my case. And the court order clearly states on record that my case was dismissed for granting the defendant disputative motion for summary judgment and plea to the jurisdiction.
So now you're talking about the July 7th hearing.
July 7th, yes, that's okay. Where the case was dismissed. And then when I went to court on my motion to vacate and reconsider or reinstate, and then accept my response to their plea out of time, they just swayed the whole matter and put it out of focus that I had adequate notice, I had this. I said, that's not the issue. I came to court to vacate what the order says. The defendant objected, and the court sustained the argument that I had to explain why I could not come to court. I did that for the courtesy of the court, that even though the dismissal order was not based on that. I explained, just like I did not hear from the court. I had emergency family matters I took care of, and then when I was called, as soon as I came to work on the 7th, that was the day of the hearing, the first thing I did for listening to the message was to call Nancy, say, hey, I didn't know about this, but I'm making plans to show up. The court and then the defendant did not understand why, as soon as I hear the message, I should just leave. That cannot happen. I have to make emergency arrangement. The work is not mine. Even the city manager cannot just leave without seeking permission. So I had to seek permission from my supervisor, who was even in the meeting. And then I carpool with my wife from a different location in Oak Cliff, that I have to bring the car or just give me a ride here. You know. So had it been, all the issue is centered on, had it been a clear, sufficiently clear, timely notice, all these arrangements wouldn't occur, because each time I'm coming here, just like today, I've already put in my leave request so that I don't have to interfere with work. But when notice is untimely and sufficiently unclear, just like what was left on my phone, then I have to make emergency arrangement to come. I cannot just come here, even though this matter is important to me. My livelihood is equally important. I cannot just leave for them to fire me. You know, so that was another important issue. Then, based on those court orders themselves, had problems. And if you look at page 2, which I state what this appeal is about, it lists all that was wrong.
Now, are you referring to the brief you filed or the document you have handed the court this morning?
I tried to consolidate all of them together. This, but to make it simple, I just consolidate all those things, the fault that the court committed together with the defendant. But that doesn't mean that what my briefing is. Just one is to consolidate and make it simple for everybody.
Okay, because we'll have to decide and rule on whether this is admissible. at this late time.
Right, but yes, ma'am. So all that the court did wrong, which is in my brief, has been consolidated here. So it only makes it simple rather than to make it any different. And the list goes on that I did not have, the court explicitly disregarded or they took no action about my motion for continuance. The court failed to give me fair, timely, and sufficiently clear notice. It goes on and on, failing to take any action about my motion to vacate. And then they unreasonably restricted me. Instead of focusing on what dismissed my order, they restricted me just to talk about why I didn't show up. And there was no order showing that my case was dismissed for want of prosecution. That was unreasonable. You know, they improperly dismissed this case with also prejudice after sustaining plea to the jurisdiction. And even in the order, it stated that his argument was meritorious, meaning it had merit. And in most cases, you know, we don't just dismiss cases with prejudice for it being or on summary judgment because it had merit. No, so all the list here, I don't want to waste the court's time, is stated on there.
But wait a second, let me ask you something. The suit wasn't dismissed because it had no merit. It was dismissed for a lack of jurisdiction.
Right, and what I'm saying is that if that was how, what was the word meritorious in the disorder, in the dismissal form for? What does it relate to? So that, and not only that, the dismissal form also have another inaccurate statement in there. The dismissal form state that after listening to both arguments and responses from both parties and all that, then they found that the defense or the appellees were meritorious. Because of the court's mistake, I did not even show up in court. Because I didn't have notice to be there timely. So how could they have included my response and then the argument in the dismissal order? That was inaccurate. So,
Mr. Nkansa.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir.
The record reflected in part a letter that was presented as having been mailed to you with a return receipt requested for the signature on it, giving notice of the July 7th hearing. Have you looked at that part of the record? And is that, are you contesting that you did not sign or did not receive that certified mail letter?
I did receive it, but that's my point. The point I'm making here is not that I did not have notice of their dispositive motion. That's what the certified letter is for. What I'm saying is that they submitted their dispositive motion. I put in a motion for continuance.
And I read your motion, and I read your document. But you're not disputing that you had the notice. You responded by filing what you believe to be an adequate notice on motion for continuance.
Definitely, sir.
And your grief in terms of how that was handled is that you thought the motion for continuance had been granted and you were not going to have to appear on July 7th.
Not only that. What I was saying is that I'm not saying that my motion was continuing just for putting it in. I was expecting from the court what they were doing with my motion. Whether we have to come for a hearing on that, and when we have to come for a hearing on that, and what they were doing with my continuance. I didn't have any such notice from the court.
All right, let me ask you one other question. When is it that you contended you first knew of the grievances that you've raised in your lawsuit? What date in 04 or 05, whatever date you contend it was, what was the date that you contend you were first put on notice of the actions of the committee in determining that you would be dismissed from the program?
I had that notice when I received a response to my open record request somewhere in January or February. But
January, February of which
year? Of 2006 or so. But the point here, and I'm glad you brought that question. My contention here is that the defendant is arguing that the statute of limitation had passed for most of my claims. That's not truly accurate. just because they themselves use my inability to exhaust my administrative remedy as a defense. And then they turn around and say that the period I pursued the administrative remedy doesn't toll the statute. That it means they don't want to give me any room to breathe, because I couldn't, by UTA terms, we are obligated to pursue internal administration remedies before you can take any relief with the court. And you cannot concurrently at the same time pursue both. You know, so if they were using as a defense that I did not exhaust my administrative remedy, how can I do both at the same time? I don't think.
Let me ask you this, sir, and I know your time's up, but I'm interested in asking this question if I can. Your document that you handed us today, which is included in your record, is Exhibit U that you marked on a December 7, 2006 letter. Do you recall that?
This letter?
No. It's the letter that you signed that you addressed to Dr. Philip Cohen, Dean of Graduate School, dated December 7th, 2006.
Oh, okay.
And the reason I'm asking you about this letter is that the letter that Dr. Cohen wrote on May 30th of 2006, to me, is a good, clear indication that all administrative remedies have been exhausted and everything was finished except for the offer to extend an opportunity for you to accept a chance to start over in your doctoral work.
With all due respect, I think I disagree. Number one, and the time was not enough for me to see. To state that if you look at exhibit tab A, you see, how is it that, and I was arguing my case that my dismissal is arbitrary. Arbitrary dismissal called for full range limit of due process. Before the test, if a person is failed, before even a test takes place, an examination takes place, and then they will go around to forge documents to rationalize the action they have to take, the permission they need to seek from graduate school, they never did it. He's calling them professionals. There's no way a professional would do the thing that they did. Professional would never say the dissertation is not good without having an evaluation sheet or markup document.
I understand.
Okay, but what coming to
your understand your contentions on what happened, and I'm not looking to go back to rehash that or to re-examine that. What I am concerned about is that it appears clearly from the record in terms of the written documents, even your letter that you sent back on December 7th, that you were given notice on May the 30th, 2006, that all administrative matters were completed and that any action that you were going to take beyond accepting the offer to go back in and start again would be that you'd have to take your remedies to court. And I don't understand how there could be any other reading of this language, because it's so specifically clear what Dr. Cohen said in his May 30th, 2006
left. Yes, sir. But during that time, I was still negotiating with the dean. The cross of the matter is that I've already spent almost $250,000 on this degree, and it was not clear whether they were going to after the first semester. It means if I couldn't graduate, I have to also incur all the subsequent costs. That didn't happen because of my mistake or because I was not able to do academic work.
I understand. You see, thank you very much for answering my question, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Your time is up. We will go now to Mr. Contreras.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honorable Justices. On behalf of Defendants University of Texas at Arlington and the five individual defendants, We've had this position since this appeal has began, since this entire case was filed. I was the attorney that was personally assigned to this entire case from day one. I have personal knowledge of everything that happened, all filings that had been filed, and the arguments that were set forth by both parties. For those reasons, the record is clear through the evidence that had properly been presented to the trial court that there are three reasons why this court should affirm the trial court's judgment. Number one, the appellant was no due process was required prior to his academic dismissal. That's what this case is all about. It's not about some lateral tort claims that don't relate to appellants seeking a doctoral dissertation from the university. It relates to an academic dismissal. And the appellant, under the controlling law of the U.S. Supreme Court Horowitz, under the First Court of Appeals case, Island versus Wolf, which is strikingly similar to this case with regard to the claims made, due process, equal protection, an attempt to assert a breach of contract claim, it's strikingly similar. All those cases make clear that no due process was required prior to academic dismissal. The second reason why this honorable court should affirm the trial court's judgment is because plaintiffs clearly sued both the state and he sued the individuals related to their involvement in the course and scope of their job duties as employees of the University of Texas. The application of the Election of Remedies Code 101.106 clearly applies as the reason why all the claims made against the five individuals were properly dismissed. Additionally, the trial court also did not err in granting the defendant's pleaded jurisdiction or motion for summary judgment because the claims that appellant had asserted, he sued the state. There's no doubt about it. It's clear in the record that he sued the state. And the claims that he asserted against the state are barred by sovereign immunity or were properly dismissed as a matter of law because there could be no genuine issue of material fact with regard to the slew of claims that just simply don't apply here. Takings claim, conversion of property, which I'll get into in a little further detail. But with regard to the due process claim, as shown through the briefing of the appellant, which is a common tactic by students that were dismissed, is they attempt to recast what happened to them as a disciplinary dismissal. That's not what happened. It's true that there had been some concerns about plagiarism in appellant's work, but there was never any formal proceedings on misconduct against the appellant, and there's no evidence in the record that he was dismissed because of any type of misconduct for disciplinary reasons. The record clearly shows through the evidence of the affidavits and through even a joint statement by the majority of the committee members was that the appellant was dismissed for merely for academic reasons. And courts all across the nation, over 30 years ago, the United States Supreme Court hit this exact issue right on the head in Horowitz in 1978. Justice Rehnquist delivered that opinion, and he basically said courts are not equipped for second-guessing the judgment of academics in an academic context. And so for that reason, because if a student is dismissed for academic reasons, no hearing prior to dismissal is required. And that's just simply the black and white law that applies here. So therefore, any attempt to recast his claim as anything different from an academic dismissal is just simply flat out incorrect. With regard to any claim of substantive due process, the case law is clear on that as well. The Island v. Wolf case makes that proposition a lot very clear. If any evidence exists whatsoever that professional judgment was exercised in the academic dismissal, any evidence whatsoever that has been presented in the record, the substantive due process inquiry ends right there. And because courts may not override the faculty's professional judgment. As I mentioned in the record, Clerk's Record Volume 1, page 189, a joint memo from the majority of the individuals that were part of the dissertation committee clearly state that in their judgment, the appellant's dissertation did not meet the doctoral level scholarship required at the university. The bottom line here is that there has to be some sort of minimum level of academic requirements for, especially at the doctoral level. Otherwise, it wouldn't be fair to the others who worked so hard and met all the academic requirements and received their degree for the appellant to come in and basically ask that the university relax their standards for him. So what he was really asking for, based upon the dissertation committee's review of his work, what he was really asking for was to be treated more favorably and to be given an excuse not to follow the academic standards required by everybody else that had been through the exact same process, that had done the work to obtain their PhD. That's what he's asking for since day one. And the record shows also through the affidavits, and I quote the affidavit of Sherman Wyman, one of the professors on the doctoral dissertation committee, as further evidence that professional judgment had been used in making their conclusion that the academic rigor and data collection of the conceptual basis of the appellant's dissertation were unacceptable. And it was the consensus of the entire committee. I think the due process analysis ends right there. And I'll leave it at that. I think the case law is clear with regard to any other arguments on due process. But I think we really do have to consider what is at stake here. Is that appellant is seeking not a degree from a paper mill, not a degree from online degree. He was asking to be awarded a PhD, which is the highest degree that any university across the nation can award a student. And I think that, once again, that has to mean something for any student at a university, and it has to mean something for the University of Texas to have to impose, once again, some sort of minimum level of academic rigor and scholarship to be entitled to that degree. Otherwise, a doctoral degree from the University of Texas, it would be worthless. It would be worth nothing if they allowed one applicant to skirt the academic requirements and obtain his degree. With regard to the election of remedies application, it's clear from the original petition that was filed that the appellant sued initially the University of Texas as an entity. It's clearly a state entity, and I believe he named five individuals in their official capacity. I believe that's what the original petition said. The appellees filed a plea of jurisdiction based on sovereign immunity to, I believe, the majority of those claims. That's right out of the statute application of subsection A of 101-106. Upon filing of a suit against the state, any and all individual employees are dismissed automatically if it relates to the same subject matter. And we've seen appellant's brief where he tries to argue that we're dealing with a different subject matter. I just don't see how that argument can be made. It's not like the appellant went out and had a car wreck with one of these professors on a dissertation committee the day after he was dismissed and has some separate claim. All of these professors that were involved in this case directly were involved in the dissertation process or received some sort of letter or complaint from Nkanza as a result of his dismissal. So the argument that we're dealing with different subject matters, that argument is simply incorrect. And the application of that statute clearly is appropriate, and the trial court did not err in granting the appellee's motion to dismiss based on the election of remedies. And once again, the statute of limitations here, clearly he filed his lawsuit much, much later beyond the two-year statute of limitations deadline imposed for any tort claim that he may have asserted. And actually, the public records inquiry that the appellant spoke of was made in January of 2005. It wasn't made in 06. It wasn't made in 07. The record clearly shows that. And so it's our position that the the clock started ticking in 05 to bring any claims against the university or against any of the individual defendants. He filed his lawsuit, I believe, in October of 2008. October 30th, 2008. I just don't see how he can get past that. And the appellant hasn't cited to any law which would support his proposition that there's any tolling argument that would apply to that for a negligence claim, a DTPA claim, which incidentally is barred by sovereign immunity, or the slew of other claims that he asserted, premises liability, conversion of property. All those claims are barred by the two-year statute of limitations, and there's no getting around the application based on the flat-out deadlines that are clear here in the record. Sovereign immunity, that's another obvious reason why the trial court did not err in granting the appellee's plea to jurisdiction. Our plea was clear. He sued the state. He sued the University of Texas at Arlington. That's a state agency. Case law is clear on that. The majority of tort claims, including, as I mentioned again, negligence, DTPA, premises liability, and conversion of property, all these types of claims, absolutely, Texas law provides absolutely no waiver or consent by the legislature for an individual to proceed on those claims. The appellant never overcame his burden to show waiver or consent, and therefore those claims were also properly dismissed as a matter of law. There's simply no getting around that. And all the other claims were dismissed as a matter of law, either against the university or the individuals. For example, the constitutional takings claim simply doesn't apply. That claim applies to real property. It doesn't apply to an intangible property, which, I mean, a PhD is intangible property. You can't go to the store and go buy a PhD and it's some sort of good or service or something that you can just put in your pocket and say you have. The entitlement of a doctoral dissertation is an intangible property right, if anything, not a tangible, much less real property, which is the obvious reason why a takings claim can't apply. These are just simply a slew of claims, basically throwing the book at the state on every possible claim that the appellant could possibly invent to bring against the state, which simply don't apply. I don't believe I need to go into detail into each and every claim, but I'm prepared to answer any questions that the court may have on those. But once again, we're dealing with a forgery claim, conversion property, DTPA claim. All these claims are simply barred by sovereign immunity, and also a claim that was asserted under the Texas Penal Code. I mean, I looked at this stuff and kind of didn't really know how to react at first, and until it was clear that, you know, you just can't bring these claims. And finally, on the whole issue of the reason of the denial of appellant's motion for continuance, the record shows that the notice of the hearing on the appellee's dispositive motions was sent out at least over 40 days before the hearing date. And appellant simply cannot get out of the fact that he did receive that, not only by evidence of the green card, but also by the fact that he himself filed a motion to continue, which on its face was facially defective. Didn't contain, it wasn't sworn or verified. Didn't appellant violate the local rules? He didn't confer with opposing counsel. And he just simply didn't even set it for hearing. And then he comes to the trial court and tries to dictate to the trial court how they should manage its docket, and basically was asking that he be treated more favorably than the opposing party simply by the fact that an attorney represents him. Texas law is clear that pro ses are held to the same standard as licensed attorneys. I believe that's the Mansfield case. And there's no getting around that, and it would be unfair if it was any different. I've had several instances as an attorney where I wish I could have just filed a notice of continuance to the court and say, hey, you know, I'm busy, I have an emergency, or I can't attend that day. I really wish I could have just done that many times. But I can't just do that. No one can. No one's permitted to do that. They have to get a court order continuing the hearing. The appellant never did that. He never set it for hearing. The trial court didn't even have to call him that day. They were trying to be helpful and do him a favor and to keep him apprised as to what was going on, but it was the appellant's duty to set that matter for hearing, which he never did. And that's basically the bottom line of what happened. And during these hearings, the reinstatement hearing, the trial court abundantly explained to the appellant how the court manages docket and the reasons why the court proceeded in his absence on July 7th. To apply those, so therefore the trial court did not abuse its discretion in proceeding with the hearing, and even if it did, as a matter of which it did not, we dispute that, but even if it did not, even if it did, the claims would have been properly dismissed anyway as a matter of law for the reasons discussed. So for those reasons, Your Honors, I would respectfully request that the appellate court affirm the trial court's judgment on all claims and this case be dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Contreras. Mr. Inconsa, you have a five-minute rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors. First of all, you know, I think the defense attorney himself does not know what this case is about. He has had it for almost 2-3 years now, but he keeps saying that it's academic dismissal. Here, and I point to the July 7th trial, he himself said, for example, Dean Cohen is not, the dean was not the dean of the graduate school whom plaintiff wrote letter to ask him for, to appeal his case, was not even an appropriate channel to do so, which was not even appropriate. Here's the grievance procedure telling us how you have to start from your department to the dean. He doesn't know what's going on with this case. And number two, he's saying that this is an academic dismissal case without explaining to the court what's the difference between arbitrary dismissal and academic dismissal. Here's plaintiff. This is the UTA's own public administration doctoral manual. If you look at the list, I completed all this first time. First time, what people fit 3-4 times, they allow them to come. I try all up to the dissertation level. There are two aspects of dissertation. When you listen to the recommendations of your committee, the final part of the dissertation is just like a ceremony. In a critical case whereby you go against them, then they can put you on stand to defend. Maybe you come out with something important with respect to do so. In my case, I did everything accordingly. And even according to their manual here, if you look at if you look at the aspect of the comprehensive examination, the credit dissertation hours, it stated clearly, students may not register for the dissertation if they are not in good academic standard or they are not good academically. You see, I was supervised by Dr. Hisson as advisor and he was the chairman of my committee. He has to allow me to register all those classes. You know, so I don't think he knows what he's talking about. How can the faculty, the only one among the faculty that was on my committee, Dr. Cole, he was the only professor. The rest of them were associate professors. And he endorsed that they should pass me, even though he was not aware. He sent in his vote for me to pass. And you read the dean's letter. That dean's letter is an indictment to the department about all the various violations of their own policy. You know, so you cannot just say that it's an arbitrary academic dismissal. Why is it arbitrary? And he keeps, so in case law, what I want to tell you is that case law stems from reason. Case law stems from reason. There are some laws that has not been made because precedent had to be set. Maybe my case is an example. If some action is unreasonable to the common person on the street, that action is arbitrary. You know, you cannot say that the same professionals, Dr. Wyman never even gave, consulted him several times for feedback. He never gave me any feedback. And he has nothing written to show that any feedback was given about the standard of the dissertation. The dean himself said, dissertation cannot be registered for defense while it's not ready. You can't face somebody who have approved his dissertation and defend that the dissertation itself is substandard. Then why did they approve it in the first place? And if you read, and I went to the coordinator, the University of Texas coordinator. You know, I tried to exhaust every means for a resolution of this case. And if you read Dr. Cole's email to Dr. Hisong. And he said clearly here that I do support passing the student. He's the only professor. The rest of them are under him. He was the dean of our department. How can he pass something that's substandard, something that you yourself approved and came back and said you cannot approve? And how can the committee be professional when the quorum, just like here, if this court is supposed to have three justices, one justice cannot hold the court. It's the same thing with my dissertation. Five members supposed to sit in the defense if it was even not a hoax. And only two, even the other third one said he wasn't a member of my committee. You know, they were in this disarray, didn't know what they are doing. Are these the people he called professionals? That 18 years, you don't know how to attend a dissertation with a markout dissertation, with evaluation sheet and all that to show the standard of the dissertation. And then he's talking about the same person swearing an affidavit, whereby that person himself has signed all a document in here proving that, for example, I was the one. Here is the comprehensive proposal, my dissertation proposal. Proposal is the greatest hard work in dissertation. It has to be approved before you can even go on and gather information for research.
Okay, your time is now okay. Up.
And Dr. Wyman is talking about is here as a member of that committee which passed my comprehensive proposals. And he turned around and said that he never, both his son and Wyman said they have never even met me because there was a fiduciary charge against them, that they have never seen me while I've taken numerous courses with them. So the whole thing was a hoax. They tried to cover up for their mistakes after it was too late. And then if this is the way UTA runs this for everybody like he's saying, then I propose that we have to suggest for the school to close down. Thank you, Honorable Justice.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your arguments today and your briefing, and your case is now submitted.